If you're purchasing a new home or refinancing your existing home, then you need to call Team Hochberg, your trusted local lender, 855-563-2843, or visit 56david.com. Atlantic Coast Mortgage, Equal Housing Lender, NMLS 643-114.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. Charles Schutt is a former Chicago priest who left the church after 17 years and then successfully moved to the world of corporate recruiting, and he wants you to know why. He's got a new book out called A True Story of a Catholic Priest, Why I Got In, Why I Got Out, and What I Learned Through It All. I think you'll learn quite a bit about his thoughts when it comes to religion and Catholicism in this interview coming up, and I hope you listen. And oh, I should tell you, Charlie Schutt was the guy who was supposed to marry me. He was going to marry Sharon and me. And through this whole crisis of leaving the priesthood, we were left at the altar. That wasn't quite that bad, but Charlie moved on and we were married by someone else. I am going to ask him about that coming up in this podcast. So let's start with a welcome. Charlie, welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Good being with you.
Okay, so we've known each other for a long time. And I just have to start with the fact that this is a remarkably telling book. You didn't hold much back. And that had to be a conscious decision, right?
It was. Actually, and it started like, 30, 40 years ago when I wanted to take a leave and go into the real world after the priesthood and then come back and tell the story of what happens and what did happen and what will happen. So, it was intentional all the way. Pretty easy writing, though, because I just did it chronologically, you know, from birth to, not death, but at least close to it.
the priest world isn't the real world?
The priest world is not the real world. In many ways, I mean, it's a very helpful world, but the way you're trained and brought up and things like that, it's sort of outside of normal living.
I want to get to that, but I want to start first. One of the reasons I like this book is because it's a Chicago story, too. It's about growing up on the North Side, going through the school system and all of that. You had a pretty remarkable family.
Yeah, we're a typical Northwest Side Polish-German family. Grew up, around Portage Park, actually right across the street from Chopin Park. Everybody called it Chopin Park instead of Chopin Park, even though everybody was Polish. They couldn't pronounce Chopin. But it was four of us, actually two families. My brothers were 11 and 9 years older than me, and then my sister's 2 years younger. So it was almost like two families. Grew up Northwest Side, father two jobs, mother stay at home, and pretty typical of the 1950s.
And maybe appropriate that you lived across from Chopin Park, because were both your brothers musicians?
Both of them went on to get their doctorates in music. Yes, they taught both piano and violin across the country. Yes, they
did. Did you feel pressure to become a priest?
Well, as I said in the book, I think, yes and no. I always wanted to make the world a better place to live. And one of the ways of doing that, I thought at that time, was, to be a priest, because it was sort of exciting. The church was Vatican Council too, and things are happening. But a lot of the initial spirituality, let's say, was my mother and, making us pray and go to mass and things like that. And I was sort of initially caught up in investments and incense and candles. But that dropped very quickly when I got into high school.
Tell me, I'm interested in the idea of young boys and young men being celibate, going through the seminary or through Catholic school. How often did that not happen?
Oh, in high school and college and even after that, everybody has their own story, but celibate basically means you don't get married. It doesn't mean you don't have sex. So, there was a lot of cheating around the edges, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. I dated in high school and college and, even as a priest, had various relationships. But, the whole idea of celibacy means you don't get married. And that was you know, sticking to the law pretty much so.
So you could you could remain celibate in the seminary and date? I mean, did that happen?
Yeah, if you had a girl who was open minded to that, a lot of times the girls would get, you know, some were very intrigued by the whole idea of, you know, going out with a seminarian or going out with a potential priest and things like that, you know, and others were sort of scared away. So you had to find the ones that were more amenable to the idea.
Okay, yes. You brought up the idea of the Second Vatican Council, and in the phrase that you, I think, borrowed from the other religious leaders was that they were going to open the windows and let the fresh air in. It was sort of a time of promise for, I don't know, a shift in priorities for the church. Or tell me about that time and why that attracted you.
Well, what happened was, I mean, growing up, you know, as I said, you know, initially there was the church and going to mass and being a good Catholic boy on the northwest side of Chicago, going into the basement to masturbate so nobody would see you or hear you, running over to church, you know, to confess your sin two or three times a weekend. So it was that goodness. But then all of a sudden there was a movement, as I, you know, would read the papers, you know, Kennedy was elected. And then the Vatican Council was happening with John the 23rd. All of a sudden, there was the women's movement, women's liberation, civil rights movement, the Vietnam War, drugs, the Beatles, the British invasion. All of a sudden, all these things happening to a 12, 13-year-old guy going, oh, my God, this is unbelievable. And how could you make sense of all of it? The world just exploded for all of us. During those 60s. And so all of a sudden it was like, well, how can I help make the world better? You know, Kennedy said, you know, God's work must truly be our own. So yeah, that's right. You know? Yeah. So all of a sudden I got the idea of, I wanted to be a Mary Knoll priest. Initially, I wanted to go to Africa. I wanted to be a missionary. But then I talked to one of the good nuns at St. Ferdinand's Parish and she said, Charlie, you don't want to do that. You want to stay in Chicago. So then I met some guys from St. Ferdinand's, eight of us. Then there were nine of us. We all went to Quigley. And there's power in numbers. You know, it's sort of like the a tribe, you know. We all had the same goal. And that's what happened, you know. And all of a sudden you start, you know, thinking that way. And we had great role models as priests during those times. Dick Morrisrow, who was a priest at that time, went down and to march with Martin Luther King. And there were other priests, you know, who lived and worked with us in the seminary who were doing all kinds of wonderful things with families and with children and, you know, improving people's lives in the inner city. And it was a great time. I chose well at that time.
Yeah, it strikes me. I mean, I'm younger than you, but I grew up in the era of the Kennedys and as the Catholic high monarchy, if you will. And that's not the right term, but
yeah,
you know, but they were about doing things, well, on the surface, about doing good for people. That's how we grew up. Is the church no longer doing that or has changed focus or what's happened here?
I think with Leo, the focus is starting to change. The problem happened with the Polish Pope, and that's when I decided I'm out of here. Because what happened was he decided, you know, that it was time to tell people what to do instead of people, you know, allowing people to find out things in their own life. So, you know, telling people what to do just didn't sit right with me because I was raised by the Jesuits at Loyola. You know, they taught us, you know, how to think and not what to think. And that's exactly the approach, at least I had and my generation of priests had going into the parishes, you know, allow people to appreciate their own life. You know, we all make mistakes, learn from those, but, you know, appreciate what's going on in your own individual lives instead of being told this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong.
And so, that's what yes. John Paul did.
Oh, he set the church back. He set the church back to Trent. He said, he sent it back, you know, 400 or 500 years. And all of a sudden now you got rituals and you got prayers and you've got intercessions. And all of a sudden we've got all this, you know, so many saints and all this stuff that I lived through back in the 50s. And I'm going, I can't go back to that kind of church. So that's when I got out.
Okay, when I think of John Paul, I think of him speaking, going back to Poland and telling the people, I think it was probably in Gdansk, he said, you know, you are worth something. You are a human being and you have value. And that message was kind of what sparked the downfall eventually of the Soviet Union. Am I wrong in that? Does he not deserve credit for that?
He did that, but on a spiritual level, on a religious level, there were all kinds of rules and regulations and back to the old time religion instead of appreciating the modern culture and what's going on. I think the church serves best when it's working in education, when it's working in social justice issues, when it's working in healthcare. Those are the three areas the church is, you know, head and shoulders above any other institution in the world. But when it gets into people's bedrooms, when it gets into people's sex lives, when it gets into people's, you know, that area of morality, I think it loses all credibility, especially when you have a celibate clergy telling people how to live those ways.
You know, and Leo did say something just recently that I mostly liked. I mean, I have children who have a transgender child and a gay child. So I'd like to see him move further. But he said, you know, the church has become judged morality wise just on sex issues, not on everything else that we should be doing. And, you know, while I'd like to see some progress on those issues, I like that, right? I like that the moral arguments about the church aren't just about what you're doing in your bedroom. It's about, are you feeding the poor? Are you helping those who need it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, the Sermon on the Mount, the Beatitudes, you know, when I was hungry, you gave me to eat. When I was thirsty, you gave me to drink. Those are the things we really tried to live out in the seminary. And, you know, I'll never forget back at Niles College, which was the college seminary, we had a poster in the chapel that's from Henry David Thoreau that said, you know, it's not enough that you're busy. So are the ants. What are you busy about? And so that was the focal point of our life. It wasn't, you know, today it drives me crazy. You know, they're being trained to sit in front of a host and pray and offer benediction and incense. And it makes no sense, you know, to go on devotions, to go on pilgrimages, to do all these kind of rituals that came out of the Middle Ages instead of being involved with life today, which I thought we were back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, you know, when we were trying to, you know, work in the inner city, education, healthcare, social justice. Those were the things that the church did.
Lindholm Roofing has appointments available now to provide you a complete roofing, siding, gutter, and tuck pointing inspection. Call 773-283-7675 or lindholmroofing.com. Tell them that Lou sent you. Lindholm Roofing, their family has your family covered.
Did well.
You write about having to unlearn things and we all have to unlearn things that we learned through the years from our youth and forward. Explain for me what you mean by that, about the necessity of unlearning what we've learned.
Well, I stole that actually. I stole that from Star Wars when Yoda tells Luke, there are certain things you just have to unlearn. And I think that's very true, especially about our religion. The issue is we indoctrinate our children into rituals and into certain devotions and certain thinking and beliefs when they're so young that they don't have time enough or they feel guilty enough when they want to unlearn those things. When they want to break out of those things, the guilt just overpowers them, and some aren't able to move that. So that's what I meant by you have to unlearn. You have to be free enough to see things in a different way. And all of a sudden, you see things in a different, and it changes your whole perspective. You know,
I was a parishioner of yours at St. Clement's Church in the 90s, where you would be. Well, were you a guest celebrant? You lived there for a time, right?
No, I lived there for a whole year, right, exactly. Okay. Yep.
But you had a different way of presenting the stories of Catholicism, I think. And this, the one I remember, and disavow me of this if it wasn't yours, or take credit, whatever you want to do, but you, it was the story of the loaves and the fishes. And, you know, we've always learned that there was this miracle that Jesus showed up on the hill and there were hungry people, and he sort of magically created all of these fish and all of the loaves of bread to feed the crowd where the food wasn't there before. And you presented the idea of, like, maybe it wasn't this magical trick. Maybe what he did was open the hearts and minds of the people there so that they started to share. Was that you?
That was me. Exactly right. And somebody wrote the cardinal and said that.
You get to that, but I just love the way that's such a more plausible possibility, and I just love the way of rethinking that story. And it got you in trouble.
Well, it got me in trouble. But again, here's another little parable. I got this from Joseph Campbell, who was sort of my guru that helped me to break out of this religion that doesn't allow for metaphor. He said, when the sage points to the moon, all the fool sees is the finger. So in other words, you know, the metaphor is pointing to something beyond what we can even talk about. Mm-hmm. You know, God is an idea. God is a word. God is an image of something that we can't even talk about. And so all these things, even in the scriptures, the stories of Jesus, they're metaphor. They're parables. Jesus spoke in parables. You know, you have to uncover it. It's like an onion. You got to keep peeling away. But when you take the object, just like the Eucharist, just like you go to Mass, okay, and they're worshiping a cookie. They're worship. This is insanity. Kneeling before a cookie encased in gold, and I know people are going to say, "Oh my God, this is horrible." But actually, it's in the breaking of the bread and the sharing of the cup that any kind of life force—call it God, call it Jesus, call it, you know, whoever—that's where the presence of that life force is. It's in the sharing of life. So that's what I meant by that.
A priest I know, if I consider a friend, said one time behind the altar that unless you truly believe that the host is physically transformed into the body of Christ, you are not a Catholic. That seems to be absolutely contrary to what you're saying.
Oh, it is. It is contrary to what I'm saying. But I happen to believe that's, you know, they're not thinking metaphorically. Okay. They're taking it literally instead of what the symbol and the sign is. And I think the only way that we get along in the world is by moving away from these apodictic statements and moving toward more of a sharing and understanding of what's really going on.
Yeah. It seems that the message is more powerful than the fact. I mean, right. If you believe, go ahead.
One other story, Steve, to illustrate what I'm saying. I was big into James Treffel back in those years. James Treffel was a scientist, astronomer, and he would talk about the world and the planets and the stars. I said, "Oh my God, this is fantastic!" And he kept talking about how the universe is expanding and expanding and expanding. And then I put the thing as, well, if heaven, as we say, is beyond our universe, beyond our known reality. And if the universe is expanding, 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 on the Feast of the Assumption of Mary, I stood up and I said, look, the universe is moving, expanding, growing, growing, growing. And if heaven is beyond our universe, even if Mary took off from Earth 2,000 years ago, traveling at the speed of light, the way our universe is expanding and heaven is beyond that, she's not there yet.
She's still waiting. We're waiting. God. Well, okay.
She's still. So the point is that you take those images of Mary assuming or Jesus rising. Those are images. Those are metaphors of what we need to do in our own life. We need to move into the heaven, which is inside of us, to know who we are and what we're about.
Do you have a spiritual life now?
Yeah, I'm talking about it.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I believe that, you know, I don't believe that there's a heaven. I don't believe that there's a hell. I don't, I don't, I, I, might consider myself an atheist, an agnostic. I'm probably more of the feeling that, you know, this is the life that we live. This is what we have here. And how are we going to improve it for ourselves and for other people?
Are you encouraged by Leo?
Oh, very much so. I mean, he's stuck. I mean, and God bless. Francis was great, too. Francis probably could not say as much as he wanted to say. Francis was a Jesuit. So, you know, he was able, but he couldn't go because there were too many of the other people pulling him back. Leo is an Augustinian, and Augustinians, they're pretty conservative when it comes to, you know, rules and regulations and rituals and things like that. But he is focusing more on social justice. He's focusing more on what I consider to be the important things of the Catholic faith, and that would be education, social justice, and healthcare, caring for people here and now. And he's definitely moving, has moved in that direction.
You're right about being cared for by your mother until you went to the church, and then you priests are cared for, tended to by Mother Church. What is it about the most priests' lives you think that people listening to this would be surprised about?
I don't think you can live the priestly life unless you're in a community. I mean, I was really fortunate to live in rectories, to live with priests where it was fun. Like even at St. Clement's, we had, you know, Joe O'Brien was the pastor and we had a couple other priests there. You know, we'd eat together, we'd get together, we'd drink together and watch Letterman at night. And, you know, so there was at least some type of a social life, but you can't live the celibate or priestly life alone. And many priests today are forced to do that. They're forced to live in a rectory by themselves or take care of two or three different parishes. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. And also, I mean, for crying out loud, why can't a priest be married and have children? I mean, the years of passing your property on to your family, that's how it started in the Middle Ages. That's bizarre. And then the analogy that Jesus only picked men. Well, Jesus was a victim of his time. Jesus lived then. He was a prophet. He picked men.
I got a lot of
women friends.
Well, I was just in Peru, and the phrase, I think, for the Incan phrase was Macha Pacha. As I recall, and it had to do with Mother Earth. And so Mary has a much more significant role in the Catholic Church in Peru. In fact, there are churches where there's not a crucifix at the center, like behind the altar. There are statues of Mary, which I thought was fascinating, the way the different cultures melded. I don't think that's quite what you're talking about, but I find it interesting. I also was surprised to learn that the evangelical or storefront churches are making great inroads. I was in El Salvador too recently, to the expense of the Catholic Church, that the Catholic Church is waning in South and Central America. Is that your understanding as well?
Well, yeah, because people, and I hate to say this, but I think what happens is we don't give people enough credit that they're able to understand. When I talked about that image of Mary, you know, it's not in heaven yet, and it's a metaphor for what we're supposed to. People understand that. People can understand metaphor. They can understand poetry. Religion is metaphor. Religion is poetry. Everything in religion has been made up by a human being somewhere or the other, whether it's Zeus or Thor or Osiris or Dionysus or Jesus. You know, a lot of Jesus's sayings, you know, he might have been a human person, but there were a lot of things that were put in his mouth after he lived and went away that was put in by people who wanted to have an agenda about something.
Okay, this is where I mentioned earlier that I knew you from St. Clement's and you were living there and you were supposed to marry me and my wife Sharon and you blew us off.
Yes, I did, because I wasn't allowed to do that then. They clipped my wings.
What happened?
Told me that I could not exercise public ministry anymore because I was on a leave of absence. So you were not the only ones who were greatly disappointed that I could not spread heresy at their wedding ceremony. Right.
Yeah, exactly. That, people were accusing you of that, right? Spreading heresy?
Oh my God, yes. Because I mean I think it was at St. Clement's, you know, when I I said, I don't think, you know, I don't, Jesus didn't believe himself to be God. He didn't believe himself to be God. So what, you know, what, though, a lot of those things were put into Jesus' mouth after a while, but well, there were always letters being written, you know, down and stuff like that. Although Joe O'Brien came to my aid in defense. He said nothing he heard was heretical. So, God rest his soul.
Yeah. Joe O'Brien was the pastor there and the guy who ended up marrying us after our first choice bailed. But I'm over it, Charlie. It's passing now.
Yeah, water under the bridge. Water under the bridge, exactly.
But you were going through that, and a priest for, I think, 17 years you wrote. And then you begin this whole different career where it's sort of like you're Mary Tyler Moore making it on your own, right? I've got to make it on my own, throw the cap in the air, and see if I can do this outside of being cared for by my mother or Mother Church.
Exactly. Because I had to prove to myself that I just didn't want to be taken care of by Holy Mother of the Church. You know, I mean, as a priest, you have your food, you have your housing, you have your insurance, you have, you know, lifetime of care, unless you decide to leave or you die. So it's sort of like, you know, you never leave home. You're never really on your own. And I said, how can I stand up in front of people in a church and talk about life, talk about their life, if my life is so distinct and so different from theirs, not just sexually, but economically and physically and, you know, normal daily living? I had my laundry done by a lady. A lady came in to, you know, clean my house, did my laundry. So you're taken care of. It's a taken care of culture. So I said, well, this is crazy. I want to see what it's like. So I took a leave. I went on my own. I made so many mistakes, you know, giving money away to getting money.
You're not too good with your money, Charlie.
No, God. That's why I'm still working today because, you know, I have none. So that's it. Yes, exactly.
But was that part of being coddled by the church or taken care of by the church that you came upon these? I mean, it sounds as if some of them truly took advantage of you. Others, you helped to an extent that was beyond your means.
I always felt that somehow things would work out. Now, and that's not believing in a God who's going to help me. It's just somehow things are going to work out, you know? So I had, you know, If I had some money, I would give it away. If I could help somebody, I would help them, you know, financially or whatever. So yeah, I turned out, I mean, I was taken advantage of, yes, but hey, you know, life happens. But I had good people always, you know, helping me throughout the years. So I always felt it's my turn to do something to somebody else. I think they call it passing it on or whatever.
Paying it forward. Now.
Yeah, paying it forward. I was doing that before they thought of that phrase.
Oh, you're rusty. Exactly. You've been away from the pulpit a long time. You're rusty. You can't think of pay it forward.
I can't. I don't think I ever used that term, but I used to have a friend at work who used it, and I said, what the hell does that mean?
So, you know, but I said at the beginning that this was a bold book, and the story you've told to this point is a great one. It's a remarkable one, and it's plenty. But you went further. You talked about the fact that your HIV status, you talked about your sex life. You talked about, I mean, why did you feel the need to be so open in this book?
There was never a priest story I ever heard or read about what it's really like. What you see from Hollywood, what you hear from people on the Halo app, all these priests who are dancing and singing and cooking on TikTok and Instagram, that is so wrong. That is just, that is not the way real life is. We, you know, we're human beings. We live, we have needs, we have wants, we make mistakes, we have error. I just wanted to put it all out there and say, this is the life of a priest, you know, or a former priest. Well, at least I think I'm still a priest because when I was leaving, I said, I thought the Catholic Church says you're a priest forever. And the guy says, oh, yes, you can still hear confessions in an emergency. I said, oh, okay. So there, I at least can do that.
We got a rodent here pretty quick, but What's the biggest mistake you made, and what's the best decision you made?
What's the best decision? The best decision I made, I think, was to go to Kellogg and get a and get an MBA, because that put me on a whole course of, you know, moving into the business world, meeting a lot of new people, having a lot of opportunities to see what life, you know, life is outside outside the rectory and outside the limited scope of priesthood.
Was it a mistake to ever become a priest?
At the time I did, no. The best years of my priesthood were the first 7 years when I was at St. Celestine's in Elmwood Park. 7 years of absolute joy and working with people, living with people. I still associate with people that I hatched, matched, and dispatched, you know, their families. And I see them all over the Chicagoland area. I'm never more than maybe 2 miles away from, you know, a drink or food anywhere in Chicagoland because of all the people I met.
Through your priesthood. Yeah, I get that. The name of the book is A True Story of a Catholic Priest, Why I Got In, Why I Got Out, and What I Learned Through It All. It's by Charles Schutt. And Charlie, I enjoyed it very much. I finished it. I thought it might spontaneously combust, but it didn't. So I think it's safe for readers to pick up.
Well, you're one of the lucky ones. You're one of the lucky ones.
You're listening to Steve Bertrand on Books. I'm glad you are. Thanks very much for tuning in. And I hope you'll subscribe. You can do that at just about anywhere where you listen to your podcast. And let me know what you think. SteveBertrandOnBooks@gmail.com. Charlie, it was great to catch up with you. I wish you the best.
Thanks, Steve. All the best. Thank you so much.